Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Well, the 2020-2021 Canadian crop is mostly in the bin. We're going to look forward to the new crop marketing season at the end of the program. We'll talk to the Western Producers digital editor about the newspaper's rich online archive of stories detailing the Percy Schmeiser situation, the case, the trial, and the aftermath from the late 1990s, which has now become a mainstream Hollywood movie. But first, food and nutritional research is a big deal these days, and the University of Manitoba has a leading program. It has just hired a new researcher for grain chemistry and processing quality. We'll speak with her now. I'm now joined by Dr. Maneka Malagoda from the University of Manitoba, who is a new professor with the Department of Food and Human Nutritional Sciences as assistant professor in grain chemistry and processing quality. So thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Malagoda, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
While you're at the University of Manitoba, what are you going to focus on with your research and your instruction?
So for my research, I want to focus on two aspects, grain chemistry and processing quality. For grain chemistry, I want to look at properties of grain-based starch, proteins, as well as other compounds. And for processing quality, I want to look at factors like, you know, environment, the cultivars being used, and how changes in the environment can affect the processing and the end use applications of different grains. For my teaching, I will mainly focus on courses related to grain science. So that's still in the works.
And, you know, you have quite a good background here for seeing the world of this sort of science. You're originally from Sri Lanka. You got your undergraduate work, I believe, in Austria, was it?
Yes, that's correct.
And then you ended up just south of us here, just down the highway, at North Dakota State University, where you did your master's and your doctorate.
Yes, that's correct.
And then you just slightly east to Minnesota. And did postdoc work there, and now you've jumped to the border. And yet, these last three sort of academic engagements have all been in this little corner of the world grain industry. What has drawn you to this region and to the crops and the foods and the processing of the Northern Great Plains in the U.S. and the Western Canadian prairies?
So I initially became interested in studying grains after doing an internship back in Sri Lanka. So afterwards, I was looking at graduate school options at North Dakota State, as well as a couple of other universities seem to have programs focused on grains. So I thought, okay, I should go to one of these places. So I ended up at North Dakota State, and I continued on, as you said, to the University of Minnesota, where I did my postdoc. And then I saw the opening here, and I thought it's an ideal location, given my background in grain chemistry and all the research institutions and the research going on here in Winnipeg. So I thought, yeah, that's something that I would like to do. So I applied, and now I'm here.
And where do you see, you know, this is a very hot area right now, human food, nutritional science, and processing. Where do you see the general area advancing in the next few years?
I think there'd be a lot of focus, continued focus on the health aspects. And I think there'd be research focused on creating healthy food and healthy snack food, personalized nutrition. I think those would be some of the highly researched areas of food science in the future.
And for a long time, and I've been around this industry for almost three decades now, there have been times when grain research and food research based on grains has seemed terrifically dull. In recent years, it's become very popular and very exciting. It's often in the main news pages of all the newspapers. It's on TV all the time. People are always talking about food, nutrition, and various elements of that. I wonder, when you started getting interested in this area, did you was that already happening? And is that something that attracted you? Or was it you just had your own interest in the sort of grains and processing research, and it just happened to come at a good time when everybody's talking about it?
I think I was interested definitely in pursuing grain science for my PhD. But at the same time, at that time, so a couple of years ago, there was a lot of work being done trying to figure out how whole wheat grains impact health, how whole wheat grains are important in terms of maintaining good gut health. So that was also something that attracted me for sure.
And this is obviously a unique time in the world to end up showing up at a university when it's not teeming with students and a lot of the staff. How have you found taking on a new academic position in the midst of a pandemic?
It's been very, very different, to say the least. So I walked around campus the other day and it was very different. So, you know, starting at this time comes with challenges of its own, because I don't get to meet people, I don't get to meet students. So it's definitely different. But, you know, I'm going to make the most of it. And I've tried to connect with other faculty members, students via Zoom and, you know, platforms like that. But it's definitely different. So you had to make that extra effort to connect with people.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Dr. Malagoda.
Thanks again for having me.
Dr. Maneka Malagoda is a professor with the Department of Food and Human Nutritional Sciences with the University of Manitoba. And this is Between the Rows. Do you remember the Percy Schmeiser case, situation, and trial? Or do you mostly just know what I call the myth of Percy, which arose after the trial? Just to refresh our memories, Percy Schmeiser was a Bruno, Saskatchewan farmer accused by Monsanto of deliberately obtaining and growing its patented and licensed Roundup Ready canola without permission. He said he didn't do it, and all that happened was by accident his crops got covered and due to the company's negligence. Monsanto sued and a complex legal process ensued. I know all about that. I was in court for the 2.5 week trial. I've been to Schmeiser's farm. I went to the wedding of one of Schmeiser's lawyers. I got to know Monsanto's representatives both in Saskatoon, where the trial happened, and here in Winnipeg. It was a fabulously interesting situation. But I've never engaged much at all with what I call the myth of Percy. That's the David versus Goliath narrative of the case, which arose as anti-GMO and anti-corporate power activists jumped on the case as an emblem of various causes they were championing. Most of those activists I found weren't interested in the complexities and nuances of the case, but instead they favored more of a simplistic good versus evil approach. As a reporter, I had no interest in that, and I left that story in the past. But with the release of a new movie entitled Percy, and it stars Christopher Walken, who many of us know as an actor, many of you out there may want to know more than just the mythology of Percy. Well, if that's what you want, we've got it for you. I now welcome to the show Paul Yanko, who is the Western Producer's digital editor. Hello, Paul, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Ed. Nice to be with you today.
Yeah, well, Paul, I was just saying to the people out there that, you know, this was a complex situation, the Percy Schmeiser trial, and there are a lot of complexities that people really, to understand it, need to unpack all the details, all the different elements. And that's hard to do in just a few lines or a quick story. But luckily for us, you are actually able to get those details and get that story as it evolved from the very beginning. And I'm hoping you can explain to people how they can take advantage of all that stuff that we have for them to understand this.
Sure. As you're aware, having been a reporter and covering this, I think this whole thing got started in about 96 or 97. And over the intervening 24 or 23 years, the producers generated somewhere in the neighborhood of, well, there's probably more than 70 stories, but it's about 70 that I've collected and put on one page. and arrange them in chronological order. So you can start at the beginning with the very first story mentioning that, you know, how this whole thing originated, and follow it right on through to the Supreme Court decision in May of 2004, and even on up to today with our editorials and the stories that have been written of late with the impending release of the Percy movie.
Now, Paul, I asked you to put this together because I thought this would be a good way to kind of lay it out for our readers and the people that come to us from, you know, not just, you know, across Canada, but around the globe, people tap into our webpage. This is a complex situation. There's a movie with a Hollywood star in it, which may draw some attention. Mm-hmm. It struck me that you were able to organize this with kind of lightning speed. How is it you were able to do that? And what other, you know, kind of things have you been able to put through, put together like this, these archives over the years?
Well, it's pretty easy. I really just did a search of our archives on our own site, searching for Schmeiser. Schmeiser is a unique name with a bit of unique spelling. You know, it's not something like Smith. And I was able to find pretty quickly, pretty easily, all of the stories that contained Percy's name. And with a little bit of help from a little program that I use, I was able to organize those and get the headline and the date, the reporter that wrote the story, and a little bit of a blurb, the first line of the story, and just arrange those on the page in chronological order. It was not a particularly technological feat by any stretch.
And, you know, I think a lot of people out there probably don't realize how early the Western producer was to get up on the web with a significant presence, and just how much we have archived of our publication on the web that's available to go in there and search for.
Right. We were, my understanding, because this was before my time here at the Western Producer, but my understanding is that the producer had a website. I know for a fact we have stories on our website from 1994. And that was ridiculously early in the whole internet game and everything. In terms, I know in the past I've looked up information on this, and I think some of the only other newspaper websites at the time were things like the New York Times, you know, papers like that that most people are aware of anyway. So we were right up there, you know, very cutting edge at the time to have a website back in that day. Also over the, you know, all those years, we've managed to amass over 87,000 stories that are available to readers on the producer website. So there's a huge wealth of agricultural information available there.
And I remember when I showed up in the Saskatoon newsroom to work, I started with the producer in 1994, but in Regina, where for the first time I had email, still had an old fax machine with a roly bit of paper that would be printed off it. But when I showed up in the Saskatoon newsroom in 1995, there was this computer off to the side that had this weird internet thing, which I had been reading about, but I didn't really know much about what it was. And that was kind of cool that it was there. And the Western Producer was already active, already trying to do stuff up on the web when that was something which most people, as you mentioned, had not trodden into. So it's kind of a cool history we have digitally. And it's incredible we have this archive. And so maybe people out there could, you know, if they're interested in prairie ag history back to the 90s, I mean, I know that's recent history, but, you know, I'm a former history graduate student. I dig these former eras. You know, you can follow so much of the wheat board saga for a couple of decades through our site, and so many other elements of Western Canadian ag history of the last, you know, 2.5 decades. I think it's a resource maybe people should realizes there and hopefully take advantage of. And I assume you would, as the guy who is overseeing it, would sort of think the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing resource. There's so much information there. And, you know, we've covered so many topics over the years and continue to, you know, I mean, these days There are, things about CETA, about the trade agreement with Europe, and of course, COVID and COVID resources and those sorts of things. Right to repair has been something that's been kind of hot the last few days. That's based on an editorial, an op-ed piece that was written in our last week's paper. Just a wealth of agricultural information there for folks to discover.
Great, Paul. Thank you very much for joining us and explaining a bit to us about this. And appreciate your time as you get back to your digital world in the cloud.
Happy to do it, Eddie. Thanks very much.
In a moment, we'll have an interview with our markets reporter, Glenn Halleck from Glacier Markets Farm. But for our next item, we'll take a closer look at fall fertilizer management in a special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Here's Grain News editor, Carrie Belanger, and Nutrien agronomist, Christy Preston.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carrie Belanger, editor of Grain News, and I'm here today with Christy Preston, who has a PhD in soil fertility and is a senior agronomist with Nutrien. Today, we're taking a closer look at the mobility of sulfur in soil and within plants, and what this means with respect to sulfur deficiency and uptake throughout the growing season. Welcome, Christy. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to be here.
Christy, what can you tell me about the mobility of sulfur in soil?
So when we talk about the mobility of sulfur in soil, we really need to focus on the type of sulfur that's present. So a lot of farmers can apply elemental sulfur and it has to undergo oxidation before it's plant available or before it's in that sulfate form. Since sulfate is mobile within the soil, that means it can be easily leached with, say, a high rainfall event, or if it also depends on soil characteristics. So low organic matter soils or coarse textured soils like sands, they can easily be leached. Sulfur can easily be leached from those soils.
Christy, what about the mobility of sulfur within plants?
So even though some nutrients are mobile within the soil, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're mobile within the plant. And really, when it comes down to it, farmers may need to know what nutrients are mobile because it depends on where you're going to see nutrient deficiencies. Sulfur, for example, is not mobile within the plant. And so what that means is it's not being translocated to those active growing portions. So if you think about a plant growing, those new growing portions are the ones that are higher up, they're closer to the sun, they're doing more photosynthesis. And so if the nutrients aren't being translocated, then there needs to be a steady supply available from the soil. Now, when a nutrient is not mobile, you'll see deficiency symptoms in those younger growing portions. If a nutrient, say nitrogen, is mobile, you'll begin to see nutrient deficiencies in those older portions of the plant because those nutrients are being translocated to younger portions.
Probably a question that farmers would have for you is, at what stage is sulfur needed the most by the plant?
Actually, for most plants, sulfur's needed in its highest quantities after, say, about a V6, right before it and up until it hits a reproductive stage. But at the same time, since sulfur is not mobile within the plant, then it's critical that a sulfur supply is available, whether it's being broken down from soil organic matter or through supplemental sulfur applications through fertilizer. That sulfur needs to be available whenever the plant's going to need it the most.
Right. So you're saying that really we should be having a steady source rather than just making sure that we have a lot at the seedling stage.
Exactly. Because okay, it will change as the plant progresses further into development or maturity. Those nutrient requirements are going to increase. It is still essential to have enough sulfur available early on, because you will have some interaction with other nutrients and you want to maximize your nutrient use efficiency, but at the same time, you need a prolonged availability.
Well, thank you for explaining that. And how do farmers ensure they have a season-long supply of sulfur?
A new product that Nutrien has is Smart Nutrition Map Plus MST. And what that allows is a slow release or slow availability of the sulfur, as the elemental sulfur takes a little bit of time to oxidize and become plant available in that sulfate form.
Right, because because AMS would be leachable in that soil and wouldn't last all season long, is that correct?
Yes, and thank you for clarifying that. Yes, since ammonium sulfate, since the sulfur is already present as sulfate, it is already subject to leaching losses. So a farmer wouldn't apply AMS in the fall because it would carry such a high probability of being lost. But it also depends on your soil type. So low organic matter soils, coarse textured soils, they carry a high potential for sulfur leaching. To make sure that it's available, there's several options. You could choose a different fertilizer source, or what a lot of farmers do is they'll do split applications. It's actually very similar to nitrogen, since nitrate is also leachable from soil profiles.
Right, and can farmers, if they find that their plants are sulfur deficient in the growing season, can they apply a rescue application?
We have seen some great responses from crops with rescue applications in season. And it all depends on what source of fertilizer you've used from the very beginning. But one thing we need to make sure that farmers understand is what's being removed in the crop, to ensure that we're applying enough sulfur. That's actually a pretty common problem that we're seeing these days. As we see more sulfur deficient soils, farmers knowing what they're removing in a previous crop, and make sure that they're applying that back so that their soils and their plants are not deficient. And if sulfur deficiency is seen and a rescue application is applied, you need to use a fertilizer source like ammonium sulfate so that the sulfur is readily available. It can be taken up almost immediately after it's applied.
Christy, what are your fertilizer recommendations for sulfur, including the forms of sulfur and also application timing?
So Nutrien has a new product, Smart Nutrition Mat Plus MST, and the form of sulfur in the MST is elemental sulfur, but it's in a very fine particle size. And so that can allow farmers to be able to apply it in the fall. Farmers don't necessarily need to apply, say, a sulfate form of fertilizer in the fall, because it does carry such a high leaching potential. But at the same time, if they apply an elemental form in the fall, we do a lot of times recommend the application of, say, ammonium sulfate or another sulfate form in the spring, because we want to make sure that the plant's not being limited for sulfur. So if they apply AMS in the spring, it's readily plant available, can be taken up almost immediately after application, but have that prolonged availability from, say, an elemental form like MAP plus MST that has to be oxidized to sulfate before it can be taken up.
Christy, if farmers or agronomists want more information, where can they find it?
Farmers and agronomists can find more information at smartnutritionmst.com.
Thanks so much, Christy. And thanks, audience, for listening to this special feature sponsored by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST from Nutrien. Join us again next time for a discussion on the factors that affect elemental sulfur oxidation and what is required to maximize this process. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you, Carrie.
This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Ed White. So here we are, nearing the end of harvest. We begin switching from following the farm fields of Western Canada to looking out towards North American and overseas demand, as well as to the weather in other crop exporting nations. To help us do that is Glenn Halleck of Glacier Markets Farm. Hello, Glenn, and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Ed.
So a lot of people have been waiting for the USDA report, which depending on when people hear this podcast, we're officially coming out on Thursday. Some people will hear it Friday, and the results may be out by the time they hear it. So I thought what I would ask you to set up for these people listening right now is, what was it that market participants were looking to have answered by the USDA report?
what they're looking for this October 9th is any indication of what the corn and soybean yields in the U.S. are going to be. The general idea, both are going to be down. One estimate puts soybean yields down by about a half bushel. The average trade guess is down about a third of a bushel. So we're looking at around 151.6 bushels per acre. For corn, the idea is it's going to be down a little bit more, maybe about 0.8 of a bushel, coming in around 178 bushels per acre. This adds to the lower stocks that the reports came out last week. So if things pan out, we could see a bit of a bump in prices come October 9th.
Now, we've been involved in something which is quite unusual and always worth noticing, which is a strong counter-seasonal rally of the last couple of months. How does this factor into that, and what's the market's take now on what the counter-seasonal rally has come from and means?
Yeah, I spoke with one trader last week, and he says he's been in this business for 40 years, and he's never seen canola so high at this time of year. The idea is farmers could be cash adequate right now. They're a little bit reluctant to sell, so the buyers are going to have to up their prices in order to entice those farmers to part with more of their canola.
Now, a counter-seasonal rally is, you know, how do we look at that? Is that a sign of likely bullishness over the winter? Is this the start of a secular trend? Or are we looking at something which is perhaps has sort of jumped ahead of what tends to happen after the crop is in and after the harvest pressure is off? How are people looking at the fact that we've had this rise now? Is this, I guess, beginning of a trend, or is it we've had our sort of early winter trend already?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really can't answer that for sure. I would say it's a little bit of everything. You know, we had such generally such marvelous harvest weather. You know, going into this year, things were a little bit behind. Going into harvest, things were a little bit behind. Now we see in all three prairie provinces, the harvest is ahead of pace. Pretty much all of the canola is off the fields in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and a little bit more than half is off the fields in Alberta.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something we haven't been talking much about, because we don't tend to talk about good news in our business. We talk about everything that's bad or could go wrong. Markets news tends to be a bit better than that. That if things are good and prices get better, we do actually tend to talk about that. But something which you and I talked about last year and has been a feature the last couple, 3 years across Western Canada, especially the Western Plains, is very bad harvest conditions. Now, we really aren't talking about that now, are we?
No. To look at the crop progress reports from a year ago, how bad things are off, like, you know what, sometimes guys weren't even a quarter of the way done. And, you know, you kind of got that feeling that might have happened again this year. And every week, you know, when each of the provinces puts their reports, you know, we see that pace pick up. It's getting closer. It's getting closer. And it was either last week or the week before, guys started pulling ahead of pace. So things are going pretty good right now. One friend of mine was out on the combine the other day until 3 o'clock in the morning.
So let's hope this kind of radio silence on the crop continues, because that would tend to mean people are getting their crop off. It's going in the bin. They're not having enormous problems. And we can actually get onto marketing a crop through the winter without the nightmare of grain storage management, which farmers have been beset with for, you know, a couple, 3 years.
Yeah, it's the stocks report came out today, and we're seeing a few drops. Corn and soybeans are down a little, but we've seen some upticks, I believe, in we're seeing some upticks in barley, you know, as lentil stocks are down, so that should boost their prices. Wheat, you know, excluding Durham, is up a little bit. So when it comes to stocks, we're seeing a bit of a mishmash of a little bit of everything.
Yeah, so it's I guess it'll take a while, like it always does at this time of year, to really sort out what farmers took off, what other farmers in other places have taken off, and what we're marketing into. I know those new crop missions and the folks at the various institutions downtown here in Winnipeg will be pretty carefully trying to figure out what they've got to sell. And then I guess the next thing you worry about once the harvest is off is, what do you have to sell and who do you sell to?
Yeah. And we really won't know what the yields are and everything like that until December, when Stats Canada comes out with their next report on principal field crops.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Glenn, for joining us today. I appreciate you coming on and giving us some light on this.
Oh, thank you, Ed.
Glenn Halleck is a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm. This is Between the Rows. That's all for the show today. Join us again next week for another edition of Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, and I wish you all well for tying up your harvest.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.